Betty Meredith is going to be doing an introduction if she can if we can get her our voice unmuted, but right now we'll just wait a minute and we'll get started in just a minute. Going with our last or the first webinar in the Fundamentals of Compliance and Ethics course. I don't have the script in front of me for the intro into the course, as Betty was going to do that, but I'll just kind of wing it. This is being presented to you from INFRE, the International Foundation for Retirement Education. They've prepared training for plan sponsors, particularly in the public sector, and this is the fourth in the series for retirement plan administrators. And what we're going to do here is if you receive the books for this course, this first webinar will cover a couple of the chapters, and then there'll be two more webinars, one in May and one in June, that will complete this course. So what we're going to talk about today is compliance and ethics, and this is something that is critical for public sector plan sponsors to understand, to ensure their plans are complying with federal tax laws and regulations, and understand why the regulations are needed and why they're there. Also, in regard to the fiduciary responsibilities that a plan sponsor has in regard to these plans, and the ethical requirements that go beyond what a fiduciary must adhere to as well. So this course, when we're done with this fourth course, and if you've gotten the other three courses prior to this, you'll have a fairly comprehensive overview of what all that is required of a public sector plan administrator and plan sponsor as it relates to qualified and supplemental retirement programs. So this fourth course covers the chapters that are included in this course is the introduction to governmental regulation, the role and responsibilities of fiduciary, how a plan complies with the regulating laws in both form, which is the plan design, as well as its operation. We'll talk a little bit about the Internal Revenue Service corrective programs, any reporting requirements that are involved with the qualified and non-qualified plans, how other parties may be involved, independent professionals in the plan, in the operations of the plan, and finally this course will wrap up with a discussion of the ethics that all parties responsible that have a role in the retirement plan should be adhering to. So today's webinar, and I do apologize right up front, I'm getting over a cold. If I do have to mute the audio for a minute, it's just because I don't want to cough in your ear. So I do apologize for that right up front in case I do have to mute you for a minute. But the today's webinar is going to cover an introduction to governmental regulation, as well as the role of a fiduciary and their responsibilities. So textbook chapters 1 and 2 will be covered today. So let's just move into what is regulation and why is it important. There's many different regulatory efforts, and we'll discuss all of them, but the reason and the most important reason why compliance is important is to ensure that the plan itself is meeting the intended goals, what it's set up to do. The Internal Revenue Service has both the federal tax laws as well as the regulations that support those tax laws that are designed to protect the plan assets and preserve the tax advantages of these plans. We're given certain incentives to contribute to our retirement through tax advantages, and in order to ensure that those plans are able to, you're able to continue to receive those tax advantages, you need to comply with the regulating federal tax laws and the rules that are promulgated to govern those plans. In addition, the code and regulations are also designed, and they're there to make sure that each plan is set up to be fair to all employees and all participants and their beneficiaries. And we'll discuss that in more detail in a minute. One of the things that's critical today more than ever is that today's environment particularly with policymakers in Washington and even in the local and state environment themselves, there's an increased importance on retirement programs. There's a better understanding today that the retirement issues are critical, and the retirement plans that are being provided to employees make up a huge part of an individual's ability to support themselves in their later years. So the environment of retirement has never been more in the media's eye, in policymakers' eye, and that makes the job of a retirement plan administrator and the plan sponsor even more critical and sometimes more difficult. There's new legislation and today it's more regulatory attention that's being placed on these plans. We are seeing some laws being introduced, but in the environment in Washington, there's very little that it's actually getting signed into law, but that doesn't mean that there's not a lot of attention being placed on these plans. There's hearings that are going on in Washington that look at qualified plans as well as non-qualified plans, and it's up to plan sponsors to be aware of all of this attention so that they can have input should there be rules and regulations issued that need your attention and need your comments. Regulations are in place to protect benefits that are provided to employees and their beneficiaries. They do that in regulations through fiduciary standards, that's in Department of Labor regulations. The standards are put in place to protect against fraud, dishonesty, and mismanagement of funds. In addition to the regulatory environment that plan sponsors have to be familiar with and aware of, you have to be aware of what's going on in courts, because if there is actions that's taken against a fiduciary, it's the courts that actually decide if a breach of fiduciary duty has occurred. And they will look to the regulatory environment to see how those fiduciaries have acted and what they're doing in regard to their plans. Regulations are also in place to ensure that the tax revenues that the tax benefits that are being provided to these plans are managed in an appropriate way. What I mean by that is that the retirement plans themselves are designed to provide benefits for that individual who is retiring. They're not designed to be used for inheritance. And as a result, there's certain requirements on when and how benefits must be taken, and how they will be taxed. Because of the fact that the government wants these assets to be retained for retirement, they've imposed early withdrawal penalties on assets that are withdrawn prior to an early retirement age. That applies to all qualified plans. It does not apply to 457B governmental plans, but all other plans, there is a 10% early withdrawal penalty that applies. In addition, there's a maximum age that a participant can leave money in the plan without beginning a distribution, and that's the required minimum distribution rules that are imposed. Why is that there? Is that those are identified and put in the federal tax codes and regulations to ensure that people actually use the money that they've saved for retirement for their retirement, and they're not leaving it for heirs. In addition, the tax revenue management component of regulations will identify and limit how much can be contributed to a plan and how much income can actually be considered in calculating benefits, such as in a defined benefit plan. The Internal Revenue Service will update those annual limits and publish them in the fall of each year. If there is a cost of living adjustment, they may go up slightly, and those contribution amounts are identified in regulations to support the Internal Revenue Code. Prior to ERISA, and ERISA is the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, legislation that pertains to private sector plans, corporate plans, not those of state and local governments. But prior to ERISA, retirement plans really were unregulated. There was no real legislative effort that required regulatory attention. State and local government employers are exempt from ERISA. As such, they're also exempt from the the regulations that support that legislation. However, you need to make sure that within the state laws, there aren't similar protections that are put in state laws that can be that govern public sector plans, state and local governments, that are similar to or even the same as what's found in ERISA. If they're not in state laws, the public sector employers often will consider and use those ERISA regulatory efforts, the rules and provisions that are put out for ERISA as fiduciary best practices. Case in point is the recent regulations that govern how fees are disclosed to plan sponsors and participants. We're not in the public sector. You're not subject to those rules and requirements as it relates to disclosure of fees and costs, but generally that's considered a best practice model, and government sector plans will follow as much as they can those same the same approach to disclose fees and costs. In addition to ERISA, there's other legislation that has resulted in regulatory advice provided either by the Department of Labor or Department of Treasury. That includes the three that you see here on the screen: the Small Business Job Protection Act, the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act, and the Pension Protection Act of 2006, which was the most recent one. There's been some other minor ones, but in regard to that have made the most change to retirement plans, public and private sector. Those are just a few of those legislative efforts, and there's more discussion of that in the textbook themselves. But the reason why this is important is that the legislative actions actually are what generally will result in the regulatory efforts that then take place. So when you look at a legislative process itself, what's involved? I'm sure you're all aware, once Congress passes a law or legislation, then it goes to the president for a signature, and once he signs it, it's codified into law. There are certain laws that actually will state or direct the Department of Labor or the Department of Treasury to then go and provide regulatory guidance to help individuals, taxpayers, employers, whoever is affected by that law, implement the law that has been passed. There are various and assorted types of guidance that may be provided. The regulations are either the guidance that's provided is either going to provide an interpretation of the law or the policies regarding the law, or it's going to actually provide you with instructions on how to comply with the law. There's rulings, procedures, notices, announcements, and advisory publications. All of these are going to be something that plan sponsors need to be aware of. Federal tax laws, I'm sure you all are aware of this, but they are referred to as the Internal Revenue Code. So when you see IRC, that's the Internal Revenue Code, and that indicates the laws that are passed that govern the taxes that are associated with our federal income tax. The Internal Revenue Service through the Department of Treasury, they are responsible for any guidance that comes out that pertains to the federal tax laws. In addition, the Department of Labor has another responsibility to provide guidance on any of the laws that pertain to ERISA. There are some instances there where there will be guidance on ERISA laws that come from both the Department of Labor and the Department of Treasury. When it comes to the guidance that Treasury provides, they provide guidance that's in proposed, temporary, and or final form. So when it comes to proposed regulations, and one regulatory effort that you all may be aware of, because it just came out yesterday or Monday, it was in regard to the redefinition or redefining the term fiduciary. It's going to be a lot of attention on that. That actually was a reproposed rule. They issued it a couple of years ago. They took it back. Then they reproposed it again. It is a proposed regulations, and this is providing the public with an opportunity to comment on those regulations and to be able to identify how they may impact their plan either positively or negatively. Comprehensive rules. I mean, you've got rulemakers sitting in Washington writing these rules, and some of them may not have, I mean, there's a lot of different plans that this is going to impact. It's important for plan sponsors to take that opportunity to provide comment. Whether that's directly through writing to the Department of Treasury, they give you specific instructions as to how to comment. Sometimes they offer public hearings where they invite people, or people are asked to come and respond in public at these and provide oral comments. Also, organizations such as the National Association of Government Defined Contribution Administrators, NASRA, the National Association of State Retirement Administrators, National Council of Teacher Retirement Systems, NCPERS, Public Employee Retirement Systems. There's a lot of different national organizations that are involved in looking at regulations and looking at the guidance that's proposed and providing feedback and comment. As a plan sponsor, as an administrator for a retirement plan, it's your responsibility as a fiduciary role is to ensure that your voice is heard one way or the other, either through direct comments to the Treasury and IRS or through your national organizations that you may be part of. Temporary regulations is another way that the Department of Treasury can get immediate guidance out that's going to be governing a short period of time before they issue proposed or final regulations. So temporary guidance might be presented immediately after a law has been passed before actual proposed or final regulations could be issued. And then the final regulations, once the process has gone through, whether it's temporary or proposed, they will incorporate all the feedback that has been provided in regard to that and hopefully address any outstanding issues before they then will provide final regulations that provides permanent guidance, and that regulatory guidance is law, and it is what is in place until that has either been amended or replaced through another regulatory or legal or a different law has been passed or different regulations have been issued. Revenue rulings are another form of guidance that the Department of Treasury and the Internal Revenue Service provides. Revenue rulings provide a statement of position with respect to a particular tax issue. What they feel is the position that the IRS would take in a certain situation. It provides official interpretations of any related statutes and or even regulations that have also been issued, and it clarifies and standardizes how the law applies to a specific set of facts. So revenue rulings can be relied upon as law in regard to how the Internal Revenue what position the Internal Revenue Service would take. Revenue procedures provide specific details, to instructional details on how something should be administered. Revenue procedures such as guiding a certain way that a feature of a plan should be administered, that would be an example of a revenue procedure. It provides an official statement of procedure that impacts the rights or duties of taxpayers and the general public. There are certain situations that are going to require both a revenue procedure and a revenue ruling. In those situations, there may be some, they may have both a revenue procedure and revenue ruling issued. Private letter rulings are additional guidance that the Department of Treasury and the Internal Revenue Service can provide. Unfortunately, private letter rulings cannot be relied upon as law. These are some, except for the individual taxpayer or employer that requested the guidance. So private letter ruling is something that a plan sponsor or a taxpayer could request that is pertaining to a specific single question or single situation. They may or may not respond. There's certain criteria upon which the IRS will consider if that guidance will be issued. And taxpayers that are the only people that can rely on that ruling are the ones that are actually making the request. So if the plan that makes the request can rely on that, but other taxpayers cannot. What they do, though, is they do provide an indication as to how something else might, how the IRS would consider a similar situation, but there's no guarantees. So employers may look at private letter rulings that have taken place in the past and say, okay, this is how the IRS ruled in that situation. Our situation is similar. You may be able to rely on that to a certain degree, that would likely be how the IRS would respond, but there's no guarantees that that's exactly how they would view that situation. The law might change, their position may have changed, so there's no guarantees. There's two additional Internal Revenue Service documents that are issued and published in the Internal Revenue Bulletin, and that's notices and announcements. And they are considered authority and may be relied on to the same extent as revenue rulings and procedures. Rulings and procedures if they are published in the bulletin. A question just came in, and I will try to look at the questions as we go. Otherwise, if I can't get to it, I would I'll answer them at the end. But this is about, can a party other than a taxpayer or an employer request a private letter ruling? For example, could a provider or a vendor request this? I believe so. I mean, you're a taxpayer, so I mean, I'm not sure that it would have to be. You have to give me an example of the question. But if it relates to a plan, I would think that the plan sponsors probably would be the one that would want to submit it to the Internal Revenue Service. But that is a good question. Unfortunately, I don't have the answer for you. I can try to find it and get back to you after the presentation. Okay, the notices are a public pronouncement that may contain guidance involving substantive interpretations of the Internal Revenue Code. Generally, they're going to be used when guidance is not expected to be published in the immediate future and the notice is necessary to provide immediate guidance to in regard to a specific situation. Announcements are more of a, they're going to announce a deadline, they're going to announce an approaching election that may have an immediate need to get that date out there, but it only has immediate or short-term value. Announcements may summarize a law, but they're not going to make substantive interpretations, and they're only going to be used if it's going to relate to regulations that are going to be expected in the immediate or near future. So announcements are more short-term in nature. So when you want to look at where do you find these documents, the best place to go is their website. So for the IRS documents, you go to irs.gov. Department of Labor guidance, you're going to go to dol.gov.ebsa. That's the Employee Benefit Security Administration. Other online resources, the Commerce Clearinghouse provides documents as well as the Bureau of National Affairs. So the BNA and the cch.org as well. So those are additional resources that you're going to want to have at your fingertips and know where to get information on any regulatory guidance that's out there and that's been published. When it's published, it goes to the Commerce Clearinghouse. So what are the role of government agencies? Under federal tax laws and ERISA, there's a number of agencies that have responsibility and authority to administer and enforce plan rules. Not only do they provide guidance, but they also provide enforcement of those rules and regulations. The Internal Revenue Service is responsible for the federal tax laws and regulations. They implement guidance and enforce the rules that are put in place. In addition to the Internal Revenue Code, the federal tax laws, they also have certain responsibility for ERISA provisions if they're also found in the Internal Revenue Code. And examples of that are the exclusive benefit rule, maximum deduction rules, participation and coverage rules, vesting and funding requirements, and contribution and benefit limits. One thing to keep in mind, even though I said the public sector is not subject to ERISA, public sector is subject to the federal tax laws. So the rules in place corporate plans that are found in federal tax laws generally are also going to apply to the public sector plans. For example, all those five examples that are on the screen right there do apply to public sector plans as well as private sector plans. So there are certain exceptions that you're going to find in the laws for certain plan types. But in general, if it's in the federal tax code, public sector plans are going to they're going to be applicable to the public sector plans. Department of Labor, the Employee Benefit Security Administration of the Department of Labor enforces ERISA. You may have seen, if you're familiar with historical information about retirement plans, you may actually see Pension and Welfare Benefits Administration. The only reason why this is there is because the PWBA is what the EBSA was. So they're interchangeable. It's just the Pension and Welfare Benefits Administration was renamed to the Employee Benefit Security Administration. This is applicable to private sector employers. Like I said, public sector plans need to look at their state laws to see if there are similar or additional oversight or enforcement that is identified in state laws that pertain to state and local government plans. And again, a lot of the same ERISA type protections for the plans for the participants and beneficiaries are going to be found in state laws as well. Other government agencies that are have a regulatory or a enforcement role in retirement plans is the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, or the PBGC. You may see that as well, that does only pertain to private sector defined benefit plans, but it is basically ensures those benefits to participants, and private sector plans are required to pay into that fund to ensure their benefits that they're providing to their employees. The Department of Justice on the federal level is the agency that's in charge of investigating and prosecuting any criminal actions against fiduciaries or other parties that are responsible for ERISA plans. Within the public sector, state and local governments, you're going to see the involvement of the state's attorney general, district attorney, or other law enforcement officials that are going to have some oversight and responsibility for the role that the Department of Justice has for the corporate sector plans. One thing that is pretty much universal, it is universal among public sector and private sector plans, is the exclusive benefit rule. The federal tax laws and ERISA require plans to be operated solely and exclusively for the benefit of participants and beneficiaries. It can have no other purpose. There are specific standards and rules that are imposed both on the individual level as well as the institutional level to ensure that those parties that have a legal responsibility that are authorized to act on behalf of the plan act in a way that is going to ensure this exclusive benefit rule, and that's where the fiduciary responsibilities come into play. So it's critical that everyone that is involved with a plan understands who is a fiduciary and what their role and responsibilities are. So with that, we're going to move into chapter 2 and talk about the fiduciary role and responsibilities. Again, briefly, I just want to mention that there has been some new regulatory action from the Department of Labor. Department of Labor, again, has oversight for ERISA plans, public sector plans, not directly involved. But the new fiduciary rule also governs individual retirement accounts, IRAs. I haven't had a chance to really delve into it a lot yet, but I will talk about that new proposed rule somewhat, as it will have an impact in the future, as well as in the future in public sector as well as in private sector plans. Okay, so fiduciary is a legal term. Fiduciaries can be held legally accountable for their action if they fail to meet the duties that are assigned to them as a fiduciary. One thing that I find interesting is that there are so many people, particularly in the public sector, who view themselves as a fiduciary when they really are not. That's not a bad thing. I mean, thinking that you're a fiduciary and you have to act appropriately as such, nothing wrong with that, but there are certain people that are part of the program. They're not going to be held legally accountable. They're not the parties that have an absolute fiduciary role in the plan. So it's important to understand the distinction between who is a fiduciary and who really is just ethically bound to do a good job. So there's a distinction there that a lot of people don't realize. So again, ERISA is a legal term. Fiduciary is a legal term and is defined under the ERISA as anyone who exercises discretionary authority or control over the management of the plan or plan assets, renders or has the responsibility or authority to offer investment advice for a fee or other compensation, either direct or indirect, for any of the plan assets, and anyone who has discretionary authority or responsibility in the administration of the plan. The key here is discretionary authority or responsibility, has absolute authority for the program itself, is the ability to make decisions and act on behalf of the plan as a whole. The new regulations, again, I've not had a chance to read, they just came out, the proposed ones, that there will be some changes to this ERISA definition. It is actually going to be broader. There's going to be more parties that will be considered a fiduciary as a result of the new definition. So this is something that will be over the next probably, I've recently read that the goal is that before this administration leaves office, they want to have this rule put in place. So that's another 2 years. So that's the time frame that this may actually come to pass, where this the definition of a fiduciary changes. The fiduciary in a retirement plan may be designated by name or by function. What I mean by that is that it, particularly in the private sector, it's somebody that's responsible for the program. It may be a position. It may be the head of a certain state agency. It may be a local government treasurer that may have ultimate responsibility for the program. It may be a board or committee that is identified, the members of that committee or the board is identified by their title, but not necessarily by John Smith. In the corporate sector, there may be actual names identified. The CEO name might be identified as a fiduciary for the plan. Within a program, there's often certain responsibilities delegated to other parties or service providers. That doesn't eliminate the plan sponsor's fiduciary role and responsibilities to the plan. It may help them meet their fiduciary duties, but it doesn't replace their name as that, or their ultimate responsibility that would lie with them to make sure that whoever they're delegating those responsibilities to is acting as they should and meeting the requirements of the plan and its participants. Anyone giving advice or making recommendations to the decision makers may also have a fiduciary role in that plan. So an example of that is if you do have a committee or a board who has responsibility to make decisions for the program and you have staff to that board, the staff is making recommendations as to how they should proceed on the investment menu, say. The effort that went into making those recommendations must meet the fiduciary standard, and that individual that is making the recommendations to the decision makers has a fiduciary responsibility to make sure that their recommendations are complying with the fiduciary standards that are in place. Another way to identify all parties that have a fiduciary function, a fiduciary role with the plan, is to identify, answer some questions. You know, look at who participates in decisions regarding the type of plan that's going to be offered, how it's going to be designed, what investments are going to be part of the plan. in a defined benefit plan, it's maybe deciding who's going to be actually investing the trust assets. In a defined contribution plan, it may be what investments are going to make up the menu, the investment menu that's going to be offered to employees as participants. Again, additional questions is a commit. Who is on a committee or board that is responsible for the plan and its investments? Who has responsibility to choose or evaluate service providers? Monitoring service providers is a fiduciary function. That doesn't mean that if that's all that individual does for the plan and they go about their rest of their job doing something else, the function that is to choose or evaluate the service providers, that function is a fiduciary function. Anyone who has the authority to bind the employer through contracts, that is a fiduciary function as well. And who has authority to establish policies and procedures for the plan, and even more importantly, who can make exceptions to the policies and procedures. That action of making the exception places that individual in a fiduciary role. So if it's somebody that's just applying the policies and procedures to applications to benefits, that is not a fiduciary function. So if they perform purely administrative functions, they don't have authority for discretionary decisions or the ability to make exceptions to a policy or procedure, they are not a fiduciary. So if you're just applying established rules, anybody that's preparing communication material, giving workshops, providing even one-on-one counseling, as long as they're not making advice or recommendations about somebody's investments or their personal retirement account. If they're receiving contributions and applying them to accounts, so any accounting function that's not discretionary is not a fiduciary role. Somebody that's calculating benefits based on the rules of the plan, that's not a fiduciary role. These people do not have a legal responsibility to act as a fiduciary. That doesn't mean that they don't have an ethical role to ensure that what they're doing is in the best interest of the plan, the participants that they're helping. So we'll at the last webinar, we'll talk about ethics. We'll talk about how ethics and fiduciary's responsibilities are quite similar, but in regard to the legal term of a fiduciary, individuals that only are responsible for the functions on the screen, they are not considered a fiduciary. So what are fiduciary duties? What are the responsibilities of the fiduciary? Getting back to that exclusive benefit rule, you know, how do we ensure that these plans, this is the only purpose that benefit is being administered? The first duty is to act solely in the interest of plan participants and beneficiaries. This is referred to as the duty of loyalty, meaning that fiduciaries cannot engage in any self-dealing. If there is a decision that needs to be made about the plan and there is a potential for a conflict of interest, such as consider a board member who's sitting on a board and evaluating providers, you know, investment managers, and they have a relationship with one of the companies that have been presenting information that wants to be considered as an investment manager. They have a relationship, either it's maybe a member of a family or even just a best friend. You know, those relationships need to be disclosed, and the individual that has that conflict needs to recuse himself from any decisions as it relates to that effort. That's what this means. The second fiduciary duty is to maintain the plan and its assets for the exclusive purpose of providing benefits. Again, those benefits go to participants and beneficiaries. This is the exclusive benefit rule. And this means that there can be no other reason for that plan being offered to its employees, meaning that the assets cannot be diverted for any other purpose except for reasonable expenses that can be paid from the plan assets, as long as those expenses relate to the plan and they are the expenses relate to something that would benefit the plan, the participants, or their beneficiaries. Meaning it's up to the fiduciaries to ensure that these expenses are reasonable and that they are handled appropriately. The third duty is to act with care, skill, prudence, and diligence as a prudent person would in similar circumstances. This prudent person rule is generally elevated to a prudent expert rule when you're talking about investment decisions. This is often specifically stated in state laws as well. This is a real important rule for a public sector employer to identify what is required of them in state laws. What it means by the prudent expert as it relates to investment decisions is that often within the public sector environment, you've got maybe an investment committee or a board that's working responsible for those decisions as it either relates to investing trust assets in a defined benefit plan or determining what investments will be made available in a defined contribution plan. They may not have investment expertise on that board or committee. If they don't, they need to hire outside experts to help them with that decision. They need to ensure that there is expertise available to them to help them understand what it is that they are, what they're doing, what they're reviewing, and what is in the best interest of the plan. So that is a critical rule to follow when it relates to the investment decisions of the plan. The fourth duty of a fiduciary, again, these are ERISA rules, but that doesn't mean that they don't apply to public sector either as a best practice or in state laws. The fourth rule is to diversify plans' assets to minimize risk unless it's clearly prudent to do otherwise. In a defined benefit plan, that is clearly that they must make sure that the trust assets are not all invested in one asset class. You can't invest everything into government bonds and you can't invest it all into high-risk equities. You need to ensure that the plan's assets are diversified adequately to minimize risk. In a defined contribution plan, this rule applies to the investment menu so that individuals themselves have sufficient choices available to them so that they can diversify their assets and minimize risk on their own retirement portfolio. The duty is to act in accordance with the plan documents and governing instruments. Even more, this isn't just making sure that the plan is in compliance today, but it's in compliance in the future as well, meaning any changes to federal laws and regulations must be appropriately and timely complied with. If you need to make changes to your plan documents, if you need to make changes to the policies and procedures of your plan to comply with any changes to regulations or federal tax laws, that is a fiduciary responsibility, and it's up to the fiduciary to ensure that that occurs. So how do you comply with fiduciary rules and regulations? There are many best practices that a plan sponsor can follow to ensure that those involved with the plan are meeting their fiduciary needs to the plan. We're going to go through these today, the governing structure, how to maintain documentation to demonstrate and be able to demonstrate that the fiduciary responsibilities have been met, the investment selection monitoring process, what's involved in that to ensure fiduciary responsibilities are met, outsourcing decisions, monitoring plan costs, developing and providing sufficient communication and education to participants and fiduciaries. So within a public sector plan, the governing structure is generally going to be identified in a state plan, in a state government plan. It's going to generally be found in state statute as to how that plan will be administered. Locally, there may be local ordinances or just how it's been done in the past that is kind of a guide for how these plans are going to be structured. In the private sector, ERISA governs how that structure of the plan will be formed. Generally, anybody that's involved with a program that has a decision-making or advisory role are going to be considered fiduciaries of the plan. Fiduciaries are appointed or even elected. Some retirement systems will have members of the board that are elected by the members of the retirement system themselves. Others may be appointed by governors, mayors, city officials, county officials may actually be appointed to a board or committee that has oversight for that plan. That's one of the reasons why it's important to understand the fiduciary role, because the makeup of these boards and committees often change with elections. So educate communication is critical to make sure that new people coming into a fiduciary role has the knowledge necessary in order to do to meet the responsibilities that they have to the plan. There's generally going to be, you know, based on the type of plan, whether it's large or small, large government, small government, may determine if it's a committee or a board, how many there may be that have a specific role with the plan. Staff that are assigned to the plan, whether again, human resource director or a benefits administrator or a board coordinator, they may also have a fiduciary role. They don't necessarily have a fiduciary role. You have to look again at the functions of that job in that position to be able to tell. When you're looking at the plan governance, it's particularly in the public sector, generally you're going to have open meetings, meaning that you're going to have public able to attend the meetings that are held to by the committees or the board members to meet their duties to the plan, and generally those meetings may be public. If they're not public, you're still going to probably provide minutes or documentation on those meetings. An investment committee or investment board can be a critical component, a critical part of that retirement plan, as that is a very critical responsibility for fiduciaries and defined benefit plans. That committee or board is going to have direct responsibility or oversight for the investment of the trust assets. In a defined contribution plan, that committee or board is going to be responsible for selecting and monitoring the plan's investment menu, the investments that are going to be part of the plan. Again, these members, whoever serves on that committee or board, is considered a fiduciary in regard to the responsibilities that they're providing to the plan. And one thing that will help with that role and responsibility of those investment committee or board members is an investment policy statement. That investment policy statement is going to guide their decision. It's going to be a way to maintain consistency in regard to any changes that occur on that board or committee. So that investment policy statement, we'll talk about it a little bit more in a minute, is a critical component and critical documentation that is going to be needed for that plan. Documentation that you have for that, in addition to the investment policy statement or any other policies that are established for the plan, is going to be something that you use to be able to demonstrate should your actions ever be called into question. Should anybody say to you, well, why the heck did that happen 5 years ago? How are you going to know if the board is all changed, if the committee members have changed, if staff has changed, unless you have the documentation to go back and see exactly why something was done, why something was not done? So the documentation will demonstrate that fiduciary responsibilities have been met should you ever be called into question for any actions or non-action that may have been taken in regard to the plan. So board and committee meeting minutes. Minutes don't necessarily have to be, you know, detailed, transcribed, word verbatim, but any documentation of a meeting should occur, should include what was done, what was reviewed, what action was taken, justification for their action, or what action wasn't taken and justification for not taking action. So there's specific information that needs to be included in that meeting documentation that includes the actions and their conclusions. In addition to the policy documentation that's needed, operational procedures are necessary. Being able to clearly identify how qualified domestic relations orders are handled by your plan so that staff can follow that, the policies and or the procedures that are in place to ensure that federal tax laws are complied with. How are distributions handled? You know, all those operational procedures need to be documented and kept up to date. Should a regulation change, should a law change, you need to go in and review your policies, review your operational procedures. And one way to make sure that you have done that is making sure that they're in writing and you can go back and look at them and review them and update them as needed. When you're looking at how investments are selected and monitored, this is, again, one of the most important fiduciary functions that a plan sponsor has. talked about this before, the defined benefit plans, they invest the trust assets, and the defined contribution plans, they select the investments. And regardless of the type of plan, the actual investment policy statement is going to be different based on the type of plan it is. It's going to be more detailed in a defined benefit plan, perhaps, than it is in a defined contribution plan. But regardless of the type of plan, you are going to want to have a comprehensive investment policy statement developed. The purpose of that document is to actually establish the objectives and the investment strategies for the plan. Whether it's a defined contribution plan or defined benefit plan, those objectives need to be identified. What is the goal of the plan in regard to the investments that are going to be part of it? The purpose for that is so that you can identify, do the investments that you're considering meet those goals, meet those objectives. The investment policy statement, and I see that there's another question. We're going to wait till the end because I'm on a roll here. The actions and decisions regarding investments are going to be based on that investment policy statement. If the decisions that the board or the committee or the staff is considering for the plan doesn't reflect what's in your investment policy statement, your investment policy statement needs to change. It's not a document that is once it's set, put in place, it's in stone and you're never going to change it. No, you are going to have to look at that document and change it as warranted, either through the industry or the plan itself, what your members need, what your participants are looking for, how they're investing, what is changing in the investment environment that may result in a need to change your investment policy statement. If you outsource decisions to a vendor as to what investments are going to be part of your plan, it is important for the plan sponsor, the ultimate fiduciary, the board or the committee that has ultimate responsibility, to know what that contractor's investment policy statement is. How do they select and monitor the investments that are offered to your plan? So you need to incorporate, that you need to make sure that they have an investment policy statement and you incorporate their investment policy statement into yours. You still need something. If you've delegated that responsibility to a contractor, you say in your investment policy statement, this responsibility has been delegated to a contractor, and then you incorporate their investment policy statement into yours. You need to monitor that contractor to make sure that they're complying with the federal laws as well as fiduciary standards. The purpose of the investment policy statement is to provide clarity and direction to plan fiduciaries and direction and professionals, meaning that this is how all fiduciaries are going to handle those investment decisions. Consistency is key when you're evaluating and selecting investments and investment managers. If you have a lot of changeover, again, I talked about the makeup of the board and committees, that they change periodically, particularly if it's appointed from the political party or the political environment, you're going to have changeover on those committees, and the investment policy statement will provide consistency and continuity. Any changes that are made in the investment policy statement, that documentation I talked about earlier, you need to document changes that were made and how those changes were going to be are made and why the changes were made. So that's an important aspect of that investment policy statement. You also need to be able to document the process for evaluating and monitoring investments. Often you're going to, if you're monitoring investments appropriately, there are going to be times when you need to make changes in a defined contribution plan to the investments that are made available to participants and a defined benefit plan to the managers that are actually investing the assets. That investment policy statement will give you guidelines as to when and how an investment manager will be replaced or put on a watch list for poor performance or some other purpose, some other reason. But that's all going to be laid out in your investment policy statement itself. When you're looking at how you make outsourcing decisions and when you make outsourcing decisions, that is a fiduciary responsibility to make that determination. As I mentioned, you can delegate certain responsibilities to outsourced providers, but you cannot eliminate your role as a fiduciary. They can share that role with you, but they cannot replace you as the sole fiduciary for the plan. When you're looking at how companies are selected to provide services to your plan, the decision has to be based on what is in the best interest of the participants and beneficiaries. That can be the only criteria as far as why you would contract with somebody. You know, you have to look at that from the standpoint of how participants and beneficiaries are best served. Generally, that's handled through some kind of competitive process. In the public sector, there often is very strict guidelines as to what process you have to use and how that process is going to be handled, either through a request for proposal or a request for bid based on the services being sought. You're generally going to have the actual proposals being submitted and reviewed, and they're going to be scored by an independent panel or an independent party. Some employers will actually contract out for that service. Some will keep it in-house and use people that are familiar with the program and other parties that maybe have an expertise to be able to evaluate proposals for you. One thing that's critical is throughout that process, again, you need to make sure that you have sufficient documentation that demonstrates that you're meeting your fiduciary responsibilities to the plan. So one thing that you need to make sure that you document is any justifications for how that contract was awarded. Why did you select vendor A over vendor B? How is that service that you're outsourcing best served by an outsourced provider instead of keeping it in-house? Once you've made the decision on outsourcing, however, your job's not done as a plan sponsor, as a plan administrator, you need to make sure that that contractor is meeting the responsibilities that is laid out in their contract, as well as federal tax laws, and if they are sharing in that fiduciary role, making sure that they are meeting their fiduciary duties to the plan and its participants. So monitoring contractors is ongoing. That's something that is a vital function that a plan sponsor has, and we've talked about that in regard to investments and other courses, as well as just the administration itself and some of the audits that you can use to help you monitoring contractors. Plan costs. Plan costs is another critical component that a plan sponsor has to be aware of and evaluate. It's not a one-time only thing. It's an ongoing responsibility to ensure that costs are reasonable and appropriate, that they're adequately disclosed to all involved parties, that the plan sponsor knows what the program is costing, and how those costs are assessed to participants, either as a direct or indirect cost. There's specific outlines, there's specific information from the Department of Labor. I talked about that earlier, that they've issued regulations as to how plan costs must be disclosed both to plan sponsors and participants. Even though that's not something that public sector employers are subject to, generally these are going to be considered best practice. A lot of the outsourced vendors, they're doing that for their private sector plans, and they're just automatically providing those disclosures to public sector as well. But it's something that employers, public sector employers, need to be aware of and address. The type of information that needs to be provided is specific fees, investment performance. There's a lot of pieces to the disclosures, but employees need to be provided this information at the point in time that they're enrolling. So before they're making decisions about enrolling and investing in specific investment options, they need to know how much is going to cost them so that they can make educated decision about their investing choices. This is in a defined contribution plan. The cost that's actually deducted from their account, that also needs to be demonstrated on their participant statements. Identified either as a specific dollar amount, this amount is taken from your assets as an actual fee, or this is the amount, this is what's net out of your investment returns. Something that demonstrates to them how much they're actually paying to participate in the program. Anytime there are changes to the fees or the costs associated with their participation, that information needs to be fully disclosed to participants so that they can make additional decisions if they want to make changes to what is actually happening in their account. It's very critical to make sure that all of this information is provided in a format that is readily understood so that they can clearly see what is the cost to participate and compare it to anything else that they might have available to them so that they can make informed investment decisions. This is the same thing that's needed on a plan sponsor basis before they make decisions about outsourcing and before they make decisions about vendors as to who's going to be part of their program. They need to know that information before they decide to contract and anytime there are changes to the fees or costs that are associated with the program. Communication and education is another critical component of a fiduciary role. Sorry, I was going to cough for a minute. to ensure informed, educated decisions can be made about their benefits. The type of education, the type of communication program that you're going to have in place is going to be dependent on the type of plan that you offer. Defined benefit plan is going to be much more focused on their choices at distribution, to be able to demonstrate the value of their benefit as they're going through their career, making sure that they made suitable beneficiary elections to ensure that if something should happen to them, their benefits will continue to who they want them to continue to. In a defined contribution plan, the education is going to be focused. How they have their retirement income paid out to them is critical as well, but initially they're going to need to have education and information about their investment choices and help and guidance on how to make investment decisions. There's a lot more upfront that needs to happen in a defined contribution plan than in a defined benefit plan. In addition, although it's important for fiduciaries to understand the cost associated with the plan itself, the cost in a defined contribution plan needs to be clearly identified to a participant. Defined benefit plan, it's pretty irrelevant because they are paying if there is any contributions that an employee makes, that's determined through actuarial analysis on what their benefits cost in a defined contribution plan. Those fees and costs have a direct bearing on how much retirement income they can actually receive. If the cost is too high and it erodes their investment earnings in the plan. So in a defined contribution plan, the fees and costs are critical to help them make their decisions, and that is a critical education component that needs to be included in the communication and education plan developed by the plan sponsor. In addition to fiduciary education, educating fiduciaries is critical. I mean, I say critical, and I realize that I'm telling you everything's critical because it really isn't a plan. But in order for individuals who have a role in the plan to understand what their responsibilities are, they need to have education. They need to be told how to determine fiduciaries. Are they a fiduciary? And what does that exactly mean? There is never an excuse that is allowable in any court or in any public forum that I didn't know it, so therefore I'm not responsible. As a fiduciary, you are responsible to know. So that means that there needs to be ongoing training to ensure that current fiduciaries understand and are retain their knowledge as to what they're responsible for, as well as any new fiduciaries that come into the plan are aware of what their responsibilities are as well. So fiduciary education, such as what INFRI provides, such as what you can get at NAGDA, the National Association of Government Defined Contribution Administrators, as well as other national organizations provide, is a critical way for fiduciaries to be able to understand their role and responsibilities to the plan. Keeping informed is critical. You cannot, again, here I go again with critical. It's important that fiduciaries understand the legislative and regulatory environment, what actions are being taken, what's being proposed, so that they can look at those, for instance, the redefined fiduciary term, if that has a negative impact to the plan and its participants, in its proposed form, this is the opportunity to make changes. It's vital that policymakers receive feedback from parties that have an interest in that guidance, in that rule, so that they can make the changes necessary so that it meets what's needed in regard to the plan and its participants. Years ago, Section 457 had major overhauls when it came to EGTRA and the Small Business Job Protection Act, and they came out with proposed regulations on 457 plans. When those proposed regulations came out, there was a lot of back and forth to make those rules something that the plan and it, excuse me, something that fit the needs of the participants and beneficiaries of these plans. It was a back and forth process, and it ended up being one of the best rule making efforts that I've seen come out of the Internal Revenue Service, and that was because of the tremendous impact that NAGDA had and the members of NAGDA had to make sure that those rules worked for the plan and its participants. Once there's legislative efforts that have been regulatory efforts that have been finalized, then it's up to the plan fiduciaries to make sure that the plan is in compliance, meaning you need to amend the plan to make any changes that are necessary with that regulatory authority that's been imposed. In addition to federal legislative and regulatory actions, it's also important for public sector plans to monitor state and local ordinances, laws and ordinances, to see what changes may be necessary there. One example that I can give you that is something that impacted both at a federal and state level. When EGTRA was passed, it changed the contribution limits. It increased 457 contribution limits to match 401k limits. Prior to that, they were set at $7,500 and they were never changed. A lot of state laws had the actual dollar limits in their state statutes, and there was some concern because unless the state laws were amended, a plan may have been out of compliance with federal laws and in compliance with state laws, or vice versa, out of compliance with state laws and in compliance with federal laws. So there was a need for coordination and some immediate action taken at the state level to coordinate the changes that were put in place on the federal side so the plan could remain in compliance with both federal and state laws. Also, something that the fiduciaries need to be aware of is any decisions that are made in courts that can change interpretations of laws and regulations, or any changes in the retirement and service industries that could have an impact on your current contracts or the current plan designs that you have that might require amendments. One thing that example I can give you on a court decisions, it's not necessarily in the public sector, but again on the private side, is in regard to the cost of programs and using retail mutual funds or more expensive investments than what might be available. There are some breaches of fiduciary duties that have been identified in court actions on private sector employers for failure to provide cost-effective investments, to the lowest cost investments that are appropriate for the plan. So there's a need for all plan sponsors, whether they be public or private, but particularly public, to be aware of what's going on out there so that you could take some similar action to ensure that your plan, or some action may be necessary to ensure that you don't jeopardize the plan status, or just the fact that you might be in a breach of duty should you be called into question in court as well. Okay, so we talked about fiduciary responsibilities, but what happens if you breach those duties to the plan? There's legal actions. We talked about the court cases that certain fiduciaries are in breach of their duty to the plan, and that results in potential personal liability as well as liability to certain plans. There's just the fact that it could cause employee distrust in the public sector. In particular, you also might face public scrutiny. Who wants to see their name in the paper for having a potential breach of duty, even though, you know, you may not be found legally responsible? It could lead to other situations as well. Fiduciary liability itself, what liability you might have is in state laws. For public sector plans, often there are state laws or local laws that might indemnify individuals who are acting in an official capacity as a fiduciary. Generally, these individuals are appointed and they're really not getting paid to be part of the oversight for the plan, except maybe a per diem. A minimal payment, but they need to be acting as they're in their official capacity in order to receive that indemnification. Fiduciary liability insurance is another protection that is available. Some plans will go that extra step and actually buy liability insurance. There have been some rules out there for private sector corporations that say that you cannot buy this fiduciary liability insurance out of plan assets. It needs to be out of the employer assets themselves, but it does protect plan trustees against lawsuits for alleged breach of duty, errors, or omission. If somebody has been found criminally negligent, however, that the fiduciary liability insurance would not cover that. Criminal negligence is just that. You're negligent and fiduciaries actually have been known to go to jail. So, I mean, that is a potential liability for failure to meet your fiduciary duties. Another fiduciary protection is a fidelity bond that would cover loss of assets in the plan of fraud or dishonesty. That would protect the plan, not the individual fiduciaries. Additional protections are just doing the best practices we talked about, making sure that the board and committee members are selected carefully, and they monitor their actions. One thing that it's important to note, fiduciaries have to police each other. If you're sitting on a board, we talked about the conflict of interest. If you're sitting on a board and you know one of the board members is not recusing themselves, even though that it's their brother-in-law that actually is being considered for contract, and they don't recuse themselves, it is up to the other board fiduciaries of the plan to say, okay, you have to recuse yourself because you have a conflict here. So you can't just sit back and say, well, I'm not the one doing it, so I'm not responsible. Yes, you are. It's up to all fiduciaries to monitor each other to make sure that they're meeting their duties to the plan. Again, outsourcing to experienced, reputable firms, doing a competitive process and making sure the selection process is handled appropriately, monitoring the plan and the contract compliance of its vendors, conducting regular reviews, monitoring performance reviews of investments, and making sure that any audits that should be conducted are conducted. We talked about this in operations, in one of the previous courses in operations. We talked about the different types of audits. You're going to have a financial audit that a plan is going to do every year, contract compliance audits, which actually audits also compliance with federal laws as well as contracts. You may not do that every year, you may do that every other year, but it's important that that is considered. So there's three or four different types of audits in a defined benefit plan. That's actuarial audits that you're going to consider and you're going to conduct every year. So there's specific safety precautions that fiduciaries need to make sure that the plan is administered appropriately and for the exclusive benefit of its members. Talked a little bit about the current issues that we're facing in regard to public regulatory efforts and potential additional legislative efforts and even legal court cases that have been handled, that have been in the news recently. There's a lot of scrutiny in the retirement industry itself in regard to the investment choices that are made available in defined contribution plans and how much they cost. There's much more attention placed on defined contribution plans because as the population ages and they actually start using this money, you know, do they have enough money for their retirement futures? You know, that's a big question mark since we've gone from defined benefit plans predominantly to a more defined contribution plan structure in the private sector, and even some reduction of defined benefit plans in the public sector where defined contribution plans are taking on more importance. Educated fiduciaries, you know, it is something that is everybody's responsibility and related to the plan, and educated fiduciaries equal a well-managed plan. So I talked about this already, but just Another very topical issue, since this just came out this week, is the reproposed definition of a fiduciary that the Department of Labor has issued. Security and Exchange Commission has been exploring the issue of redefining a fiduciary. I don't know what this latest effort by the Department of Labor means to the Security and Exchange Commission's efforts, but stay tuned. I mean, there's a dozen different emails that I had today that talked about that the new Department of Labor rule as it relates to IRAs, individual retirement accounts. I don't think it's a bad thing, making more people act on behalf of the individual instead of themselves. I mean, basically what they're saying with this proposed rule is that they have to provide guidance and advice based on the best needs of the employee, they're the individual that they're providing the guidance and advice to, not based on what's going to give that advice provider the most income in their pocket. You know, that's the basic reason for that redefinition. But some of the problems that I'm seeing with that rule is how it actually is laid out, and some of the provisions are a little too broad, and it may encompass more people in that definition than initially expected or thought. So just stay tuned. And that's something that, as a plan administrator, a plan sponsor, those individuals need to be aware of and pay attention to. So with that, today we've covered the first two chapters in the course, the introduction to governmental regulation and the fiduciary role and responsibilities. Sorry if I went through this a little fast. Again, I'm trying not to cough. So I hope that I've covered what I needed to cover for you. We do have a few minutes left in our session today. I've got a couple questions here I want to try to get to. And let me read quickly, and if you've got any questions, if you want to type them in that chat box, I will try to get to them as well. But let me go through and read this one quick. Let's see, Matthew. Okay, Matthew's talking about private letter rulings that we follow the schedule set out by the IRS to request an updated determination letter regarding a deferred comp 401k plan. Determination letter is a little bit different than a private letter ruling, I believe. Private letter ruling is on a specific issue. And a determination letter is meaning that you want to make sure that your plan as a whole complies with federal tax law. So they look at your plan, your entire plan, to make sure that you're complying with the federal laws that are in place. Generally, you resubmit a determination letter for your plan when there's been some major legislative changes, and they set out another schedule for you to submit those letters. 457 has no similar schedule for determination letters, and generally they don't submit one. I don't know of anyone that has. I'm not saying that I know everybody that would have, but it's I don't know if they are even offering determination letters for 457 plans at this time. Private letter ruling, again though, that I'm not aware of any schedule that you have to submit a private letter ruling on. That's just like if you have a question on, say, QDROS, you know, something happened in your plan in specific to a participant in a situation in regard to how you administer to qualified domestic relation orders, and you want guidance from the Internal Revenue Service on that issue, on that specific question. And then they would look at that specific question and provide you guidance on that. So that's the difference between a determination letter and a private letter ruling. I'm not sure if I answered your question right, Matthew. If you've got anything else there, if you can clarify what you're looking for, I will try to respond and follow up with you even after the session. We've got another question on some examples of indirect plan costs. Indirect plan costs are fund reimbursements. You know, direct plan costs would be how much a participant is charged to their account directly. So in a defined contribution plan, you know, if they have an administrative fee that's deducted from their account, if they have a charge for filing loans, that would be a direct cost. Indirect costs would be the internal expense charge on a mutual fund. Indirect costs might be, you know, as the plan as a whole. Let's see, in a defined benefit plan, indirect costs would be the transaction fees for investing. Indirect cost just means that it's not directly assessed to a participant, but it may be assessed to the plan as a whole, and then the participant then receives, is assessed like a portion of that through a reduction to their investment earnings. Does that answer your question, Maja? Okay, any other questions? And Matthew, if I didn't answer yours as well, let me know. Well, I thank you for your attention. I don't see anybody else typing at this point, so if you have any questions, feel free to send them through to INFRI and they can forward them to me, and I can try to answer, and I hope that this has been beneficial to you. Our next webinar is in May, and we'll talk about the next three chapters, compliance and form, compliance and operation, as well as IRS corrective programs. And then in June, we've got a session, the last webinar on this course will be on reporting, the role of independent professionals in plan operation, and then we'll complete or conclude this session or this course on ethics. So with that, I thank you for your attention and look forward to talking to you next month, and I hopefully won't have a cold then. Thank you.